Today is June 14th, 2006, and we are in the home of Ernestine Gilbreth Carey, the third daughter of Frank and Lillian Gilbreth. The people here at the interview are myself, Sammy Morris, archivist for Purdue University Libraries, Judith Shoemaker, the director of development for the Purdue University Libraries, and Ernestine Gilbreth Carey. Is the property of the Purdue University Libraries, Archives, and Special Collections, and the copyright belongs to the Purdue University Libraries. And this tape is intended for public use for research, educational, or any other means.
Whoa. And they would bring some sense of prominence to the university and also attract women to come to Purdue because it was so predominantly men. And
we're blessed for that because I felt always when I was there that it was man's school, really.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Okay, Mom, basically what this says is that you give up all rights to the interview. They can use it however they want. That's fine.
Okay. Well, they can't use it every way we want because we're afraid of commercial stuff.
I think we should add that to it.
That's what this says. They can use it any way they want.
Well, that's what it says. But that's why we've got to check that with our agent and copyright there before we sign anything. Yes. And they understand that.
Yes. We understand that.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Are we ready to get started?
Yes.
Okay. Now, some of these questions we already know the answer to, but we want it to be on the official record. So bear with me if I ask you things
that's all right.
For the record, could you give us your full name and when you were born?
My full name is Ernestine Muller, M-O-L-L-E-R, Gilbreth, Carey, C-A-R-E-Y. And that would be Mrs. Charles E. Carey, C-A-R-E-Y. And I was born on April 5th, 1908.
Okay. And were you born in New York?
New York City.
New York City, okay. When did you go to high school?
I went to Montclair High School.
When did you graduate from
high school? I graduated in 1924, and then I took a postgraduate year after my father died to be home and help.
Did you go immediately on to college?
No, I took that postgraduate year, and it was very important for my mother and for me. That had a great influence in my life.
I have to watch the equipment over here.
She's happy.
You have to crane your neck.
Are you comfortable in that chair, I hope?
I am. The tape player has jumped off the table.
Did you find it all right?
I think it's working.
Are you listening to this, where I went to school when I was born and so on, so you have it?
Yeah.
Okay. So what was your major in college?
My major was English and economics. My minor was economics.
What year did you graduate?
I graduated in 1929.
And that was from Smith College?
Smith College.
Okay. What made you choose to go there?
My father and mother had a lot of admiration for the fact that their women... students and faculty were of the, and that the faculty was geared the way they were toward women.
Oh.
And I did not want to go there because my sister Anne went there and I wanted to be independent of Anne. But when I got all through, I had visited Anne and visited some of the other schools. I had fallen in love with Smith and I knew I had to go there.
Oh, wow. So Anne is the oldest child.
Anne is the oldest child, and Mary came next. She was deceased, and then I came next.
What was it like being sort of in the middle of all of the children? You were third.
I wasn't in the middle. I was a number three. Like being an assistant mother. It was like being, I was my mother's helper, especially in the office. I was not my mother's helper with the children. with the domestic part of things, I wanted to work in the office. So when you talk papers, a lot of these papers I handled as a six-year-old in Providence.
Oh, that's amazing. Yeah. Well, can you tell me a little bit about the family council, what the family council was all about?
Well, I think we'll suggest that people read that in the Chief and Father Dozen, and
okay.
We'll save ourselves some strength.
Okay. How was conflict handled in your family? If two children disagreed on something, how did your parents work
that? Very often with the boys, it was handled with fists. And also, Dad brought home at one point, I don't think the children know this, but he came back and brought in from Boston wonderful boxing gloves. He taught us all to box.
Wow.
And I think he felt that this was not really good in the family, but as we girls got older, if we had any trouble with people coming to call, we know how to protect ourselves.
Did you ever have to use that?
I was one of the prize boxers of the family, but I didn't have to use it on anyone coming to call. No.
Wow.
But we girls learned to be expert boxers.
That's wonderful.
I don't think my children ever knew that, but the gloves were beautiful.
Yeah.
And Dad himself taught us the uppercuts and all this stuff. It came in handy. Well, I roamed around New York a lot in my heyday, a lot. And even when my husband died, I would go to New York and wander around and go to the theater and so on and walk back to my hotel, sometimes 8 or 9 bucks. And I was never nervous because I thought, well, I could handle this.
That's wonderful.
You know, I've been around in very tough circumstances in a great many places and welcomed it.
Well, I know you talk about this in Cheaper by the Dozen, but could you give me some examples of how the children helped your parents with motion study?
Well, I think if you read the typewriting chapter in Cheaper by the Dozen, that will give you the best. And the dad, in order to work with the typists involved in the contest, worked with his children first, and while he was teaching us, he was also teaching himself so that he knew how to teach these experts who went on to win the international championship for speed typing for Remington. So I don't think there's any other example that is as vivid with me, because I won the white typewriter, and I love office and office equipment and office everything. And without any question, it came from my early years of working actually as a separate secretary with professional secretaries in that office. They had a little table with my own typewriter that I won, and I was there.
Are you still a speed typer to this day?
Am I still?
Are you still a speed typer?
No, I wouldn't say with my failing eyesight that I really am, and my typewriters are old and cranky, too.
Oh,
so I would say I'm not.
I remember as a kid, she'd be typing unbelievably fast.
I think if somebody was hitting me on the head with a pencil, I would type fast, too.
Well, I have never, as an adult or a writer, been a speed person.
Mm-hmm.
As a writer, I'm slow.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's the writing process. You sort of have to be that way, I think.
It's a joy.
It is. Yeah. What about you and the other children? Did any of you ever resist experiments like that? Were any of the kids not happy about being, you know, having to type or having to do things like with the charts and other things?
We welcomed it so much because, first of all, Dad was not there a great deal. Secondly, he was in Europe and places of this type, so he came back with wonderful presents from everything, making it all very glamorous. And this way he was sharing his work with us, and we were so flattered. We were actually flattered that he was doing this. And he was a wonderful showman, and he knew how to handle us. I guess he'd been a pretty lively kid himself. We know he had from all the papers of his childhood, and he was constantly, he knew Mother was a genius, and he thought she was a genius teacher, and he thought we were all geniuses. And then, of course, along came Ernestine, very poor in math, very poor in math. And he couldn't believe that a child of his, where he taught us all these wonderful math games and so on, had to repeat a class in high school, but I did. I had a terrible time with algebra and geometry, but I finally mastered them with a good teacher, but the teacher was very patient with me. I just was stupid in math.
Well, you know, I think it's interesting that you're a writer, though, because I think a lot of really creative people have problems with math, you know.
Well, I think that's true of my friend, too. But then, you see, I went on and became a department supplier. I had to be good at math.
That's
and that's when his math teaching and the mental mathematics in buying pool tables and billiard tables, and which is some of the stuff I bought. I had three departments and two children.
Mm-hmm.
So I was...
You had to...
I had a very difficult and fulfilling 15 years or so of that in New York City.
Sounds like that came in handy.
Sure.
And we're working on a book on that now, right now, trying to finish it up.
Did people in the communities where you lived, how did they regard your parents? Did they?
They thought they were crazy. Most of them thought they were crazy. But you want the tapes, more tapes? Do you look in the third or fourth drawer? Or maybe it's the bottom.
Okay.
Or maybe the bottom. Let me think for a minute. I think it's the bottom drawer. Okay, dear, we go on.
Okay. What about the...
They were very, my parents were very generous with their time. They had... always some of our friends and some other young people in the community were over there trying to figure out what it would be like to be engineers. My parents just attracted other people and treated them like an extended family. Does that help?
It does. I was sort of fascinated when I was reading one of the books on your parents recently, and it talked about how there was sort of a conflict between the engineers who believed in the stopwatch and the engineers who believed in the micromotion study. So I was curious about whether, you know, the colleagues of your parents ever, you know, discussed those things with them. Or
well, I don't know how much you've read about the big fracas in 1921 between Gilbreth and Taylor, where Taylor took credit for the Gilbreth work, and Dad and Mother had to stand up professionally and tell them that was not the right thing to do. And at that point, they had a lot of engineers, I'm sure, that said, why don't you just keep peace?
Mm-hmm.
It would have been very stupid for them to keep peace, because Taylor still today gets some credit. I have books there where he is getting credit for that they go with work, and it's a sin. And that's one thing Perkins corrected. He wrote the New York Times on a review or some book that came out and said, you've got this mixed up again, you're giving Taylor credit for motion study. Taylor was time study, but it wasn't motion study.
Mm-hmm.
We're talking about Frederick Taylor,
right,
who originally worked very closely with Dad and Mother, was there as Dad's wife, not really as a fellow professional yet. And how Taylor increasingly took credit for the Gilbreth work and was afraid of it because it was making his own work with a stopwatch old-fashioned and dead. So he was trying to save his neck. And Dad, in 1921, there was a confrontation. Without any question, I think the whole business brought on, that in World War I, brought on my father's early death and the heart thing, without any question, I think.
Just all of the stress surrounding that.
And Taylor could be very charming and everything, and it's just too bad.
Yeah.
But the mother liked peace, but she... was with Dad totally. They had to defend this, or they would have been wiped out and Taylor get all the credit. You wouldn't have heard of it.
She wouldn't mind if that's printed.
But
that Taylor brought about your dad's death.
Well, I was saying that I think without being unkind to Taylor, that the stress of that whole thing helped to bring that on. I think we should also say a big family could possibly have brought that on. I think and earning all the money for that. And I think there are a lot of reasons, but I think that was one.
Yeah.
I don't think it's kind to say it was the only one.
Right.
Well, were there other colleagues that your parents felt very close with in their work? I know.
Yes, very, very much so. Robert Kent certainly was. The ones that went with Mother after Dad died to Czechoslovakia, they were, there was Roy Wright, there were so, I think, who they were. Henry Gant died earlier. We moved to Montclair in 19, because Grandma Gilbert died in Montclair. About 1919, to be near the Gants and other people like that, and then Gant himself died, which was a great blow, I think, to everybody. We loved him and his wife, Mary. But our house was filled with his fellow engineers all the time.
I sort of got the feeling that your father had been involved with Taylor and his group early on.
Yes, he was early on. I think he got his whole inspiration from Taylor. Then he got others to form the Taylor Society, if you recall that whole thing. And then it was a surprise to him when suddenly he felt betrayed.
Yeah, I imagine so.
Yeah, and I think it surprised Taylor that he had the guts to fight him, which he did.
No, I think that's good that he stood up for himself.
And Mother had that fight thereafter. And Dean Potter, I think that's one reason Dean Potter loved my mother so much, you know. That Potter family, that entire family, Mrs. Potter and Helen Potter, who was in the faculty, she was a very dear friend of mine. And every time I'd come to Purdue, I'd see Helen. And we were like sisters, actually. And Mother would have Helen play the piano with Robert, and Helen would cook a special supper at their house. I can't tell you how close the Potters were to the Gilberts.
I believe that. I've read some things that Potter has written about Lillian.
Well, Helen took me to see him in his last days, and, you know, he was still the dean, walking like the dean and so on, but his mind had gone. She never should have taken me there. It just broke my heart. But anyhow, I think she knew that we loved each other, and I think she thought that she was doing me a kindness, and perhaps she was.
Well, how did your parents discipline you children whenever you were too rowdy or out of hand?
Well, you know that, again, I refer you back to Chief Mother Dozen, and that Dad was very tough in discipline, and Mother had no discipline at all. For us, mothers had her habit inherited from her own mother of looking grieved down on the floor. If mother looked grieved down on the floor, which was a picture of disappointment when I have a child that I thought was going to turn out well, and I have this sad child that has disappointed me, that would break our hearts.
That's more effective than a good spanking.
Well, that was worse than a spanking. But Mother had patience and love, and my father had no patience. Lots of love, but a lot of things he did were not particularly wise. And I think that his mother was constantly scolding him, you know, before us. We thought that was wonderful.
Wow.
She would scold him as if he was a small boy. And to see her scold him, and he'd be like a little boy with it. That was the joy of the world.
That's funny. Now, did you ever live? Didn't his mother live with you all for a time?
Yes, she lived. No, she lived throughout, from the day Mother was married until the day Grandma died. She lived. My father had been raised by the mother and the mother's sister, and he had two older sisters, and the family had been left quite a bit of money by, you know, about his father's death when he went out with his horse. And the father had a big estate and a brother-in-law, either through misinvestments or I don't know what, within a year had left my grandmother penniless. She didn't have a nickel. So she moved them all eventually to Boston. She opened a boarding house where she had wonderful Irish help that did the cooking, and she taught that she was a marvelous cook. But my father was passed his exams for tech, but then decided to take this other offer. And in any case, then some years later he met Mother. And he had sworn he would never marry, and he had sworn his mother could always live with him and he would support her. So that's what happened.
I've read just very little about how your parents met. I know that she was getting ready to travel to Europe and had stopped in Boston and met him, but did they ever talk about what it was like when they first met each other?
She has written that up in a book called As I Remember. And I think, rather than my trying to tell it, it was her scene with children when the car broke down and telling them a story that really won his heart. I think it made him want a big family.
I do remember reading that. I just was wondering if...
Where it's in the book, I'm just going to save my time.
Okay. That sounds like an efficiency expert.
Are you having as much fun as I am?
I am enjoying it very much. Thank you. I was sort of curious about your mother. Her real interest, it seemed to me, before she met your father were literature, and she was writing some poetry and some song lyrics.
She got a master's in a very, very academic subject.
Yes, yes. What do you think might have happened with her if your parents had never met? Do you think she would have gone on to become a writer or a teacher?
I think she would have been a dean of a college.
I thought that was sort of what she had...
I think she would be a dean of a very top college.
Mm-hmm.
I think Stanford might have gotten her in there. She could have gone any place. She's very ambitious, and she was very tied up. I think she was fed up properly with the confinements of her setup with German parents in California. I think she
wasn't strong. When I knew her, she would never speak out. I never heard her yell when she'd come visit. Never. She was so quiet and loving and peaceful. That's what I remember about Grandier. But she had it down deep. She had this toughness, I think. So it was a different from today, where people just speak out whatever is on their mind. But she never, I don't remember, but maybe she did. I don't know. You'd have to answer that one.
Was she always as quiet and kind as she seemed to us?
Was she always as that? Go ahead and tell us about how she was quiet and kind.
No, we've already
a couple of instances.
What we're wondering is, did she ever speak out and yell or anything?
Did you ever hear her do that?
Never. This was
never.
Not her way. Never.
She
never.
Never.
She did speak out. She wasn't.
Yeah, but in a very quiet tone.
Well, she is known. There are several stories about her that are in either Smith or Purdue that tell about a couple of men that were arguing in a big engineering meeting. And Mother stood up between them and said, "Really, boys, you must stop this."
And that was about her limit.
Right.
No, then she told them why.
No, but I mean,
that's the way she
was. She never lost her temper.
She never lost her temper.
Oh, no, she just was kindness. But she also...
Mom was like this, too, as a mother. I mean, she would tell Charles, "You're grounded until further notice." But she would say it quiet. I don't ever remember Mom yelling at us or anything ever. Always spoke quietly to us.
Right.
Even if you were angry or whatever, it was always a quiet tone of voice.
It's very much a refined upbringing for ladies, I think, to sort of have a quiet strength in that way.
was true for all of them. They were just raised that way.
And you too, Mom. You were saying you were the same. You never yelled at us.
I hope I didn't. I'm sure there are times when I wanted to.
I'm sure so too, but you never did.
But she was a wonderful example for all of us. And I'm very close to my children and love them very specially. That's why it's so nice to have them here, because she would come out and see us a great deal. We lived in New York until you were 2 years old. And then we moved to Manhasset, New York, and that was not so convenient for her. She still came out to see what was what, and she was very close to my husband. And she felt that my husband's appearance and so on reminded her, interestingly, of her father, who I was crazy about, my grandfather. Okay. And when I had met my husband, planned to marry him, she said, you know, I have to tell you, he looks just like your grandfather's boyhood pictures. And I said, well, I love my grandfather as much as I can love anyone in the world. I just thought he was the most... He used to take me downtown and buy me. We'd stop at a store with all the family. They'd take the ones of us that were able to be old enough to walk. He'd jingle money in his pockets. I guess that's why we're interested in making money now and again, Charlie. Anyhow, he would jingle that. And then we would stop at a store that had little gifts like leather sewing or these bonbons that they have that they snap. A whole box. I remember one time that's what I wanted, the whole box snapped, you know, of those things. But he would say, now children, let's look at this thing, and you come in and each one of you figure out what thing that you want more than anything else, and your granddaddy will get it for you.
Wow.
So that spoiled us, you know. But he did that. And I think I was close to him because I think I looked a bit like my mother.
Yes.
But I remember he chided her one time. I remember this so well, that summer in California, we described it, chief of all the dozen. I had a mini blouse on, I've never told you this story, and with a red thing there. And he said, Lily, you should never dress this child in red. Her hair is red. You make the hair look horrible. And mother looked so surprised. Because my mother was not really much interested in clothes, and he was chiding her just like a small child, and I was embarrassed by this whole thing. I mean, how could you forget a scene like that?
So you had your mother's red hair?
Well, we all had red hair, or the color of jewels. I'd say half had the color of jewels, and some of us... I had the darkest hair, and it was the kind of a darker red. Martha had the beautiful hair, and everybody wished we had Martha's hair.
Hers was kind of curly, wasn't it?
What did?
Wasn't hers kind of curly?
It was auburn, and it was curly, and it was thick, and it was alive, and it was, people just couldn't stop wanting to touch it.
Have you ever seen any of the poems or song lyrics that your mother wrote?
Oh, yeah, I've seen them in the Purdue collection.
I wonder.
She's got them all there.
I haven't come across them, but I have.
My Sierras is one on that one. That she wrote several to my father.
They're there.
Well, that's some of the most precious stuff you have. Now, that's been used in some of the books.
Really?
Lancaster uses it in some. And,
I wondered if those were from the Smith collection. But
yeah, and then I have some other books there if you want to see where they are. But the originals are all, you've got some wonderful stuff there.
I can't wait to just go through the entire collection.
I was so frustrated just to say, and just have about an hour there. I mean, a week there, because you only had 5 days a week at that point, and I'd moved some stuff at the hotel, but didn't help me. But then there was entertaining. A lot of it. Dean Emery wanted to take me out, and Dean Potter wanted to take me out, and this, that, and the other thing. So this took me from my work.
Yes.
But I had to do it.
I hate to interrupt. Could we break
out? Yeah, I'll stop.
Anyhow, she takes very good pictures.
Oh, good.
And this one does depend on the computer for finishing it.
Yeah, you can put them right into the computer.
She's very, very good at computers, but doesn't know beads about typewriters.
Okay.
No.
Okay, are we ready? Are we ready to start?
I think so.
Okay.
Okay. You had talked a little bit about how whenever your mother was first getting started with the business after your father passed away, that she was being discriminated against sometimes in engineering work.
So it continued to be.
Yes.
This is why my father had to go to Brown and get a PhD in educational and psychology and so on, so she would be accepted in academic and engineering circles.
Did she ever talk about, after she was doing things on her own, continuing to feel that discrimination against her as a woman?
Did she ever talk about it? Well, I was with her enough to see it.
You saw it firsthand.
And then, again, if you come back to Frank's and my writings, it tells very clearly about the fact that she went to dinners and they wouldn't let her in, and nor would they. She went to a luncheon, and she was late for the next date because they had to have a waiter or a man, because she was a woman, escort her out of the club. It was the professional top engineers that were the snooty ones.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my goodness. Well, can you tell me a little bit about, in terms of all the work your parents did, and they did a lot of different things, what do you think they were most proud of in terms of their accomplishments?
Well, without any question, they were most proud of the work that came out in the Providence Days.
In the what?
In the Providence Days at the New England Bus Company.
Uh-huh.
They went in there at a tailor. It was a tailor insulation, I believe, to begin with there. And it was a braiding place in Providence, Rhode Island. The building is still in existence. I saw it a few years ago. And they went in there and turned the production, did phenomenal things in increasing production and so on. But meantime, in working out happier labor movements, but the business of, the whole business of, has a fancy name that begins with A now, but fitting the chair to the worker and fitting the desk to the worker and so on.
Mm-hmm. Ergonomics?
Ergonomics.
Uh-huh.
They are the originators of that.
Wow.
And they don't always get the credit for that. They should. So I would say motion study, the most thing, and ergonomics, but they were the first to say that the happiness of the worker was of top importance, and that had not been done. Taylor talked about just how good shovels were on manning and a few things like that, but he didn't get into the worker's mind and heart.
Right. I've always wondered if it was because of your mother's focus on psychology that made their partnership so unique, because your father seemed to focus a lot on the technical side. She focused more on the individual.
Well, he recognized all that. Remember, there he was, a successful contractor who had begun at his own wish as a bricklayer.
Yes.
And he gets into academia, and his mother with a master's from Berkeley and everything else, and a Phi Beta Kappa and everything else. And he realizes that he better put encourage the two brains to supplement each other, which is what he did. A lot of the ingenious ideas as to pushing ahead were his, but she's the one that made him work. She's the one that she really, each day she did about a six-person job, quite apart from everything else. She had her mother-in-law to keep an eye on. She wasn't very well. She had Irish temperamental help there in the kitchen. She had us, her babies coming. She was always pregnant. And then he would say, I worry about you because I think you look thin. I think you look overworked. Then they give about 10 days' work to do in about one day additional. So he might have been worried, but he still dumped the work.
So how did she do all of that? Did she ever sleep?
She came from very sturdy, long-lived, fine German stock. There's no question about it. Her grandfather had been a farmer there. And he came over and had learned his trade as a shoemaker and got involved in real estate. And he made a fortune in real estate. And so he became one of the wealthiest men in California, I suppose. By the time my mother died, all the money had been given to the children and there was none left. So they were never, our mother knew how to handle money, but the others never did. They were used to just, yeah, and they were not encouraged to marry, very few of them married. This is what drives me wild. I'm trying to write and this voice, which happens to come from one of my dearest friends, but it has to do with come down, you have exercises, come and do this. And it bothers me to death. I don't know what to do about
it. Turn it off? Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, but we all know.
Oh, gosh. I know that you and Frank wrote so much about your lives growing up, and I just was wondering, I know you get a lot of the same questions over and over. Is there anything you can tell me about growing up with your parents that might surprise any of us that we, you know, people who are familiar with the books, are there things that, you know, might seem surprising or?
I have to think about that.
Okay.
Well, I think one of the things that might surprise that anyone that reads his mother's biography understands that she was a very shy girl, had trouble socially, and when she went to college had to fight to do that, and still, with her family, had trouble getting over shyness and whatnot, and establishing real pleasure in social things. And the thing that surprises me is that when we girls came along, where some of the other mothers were helping them begin this business of dating and all of that stuff, and helping them get particularly pretty clothes for dances and so on. My mother was never aware of clothes or things like that at all. That might surprise people, because as children, we didn't want, we wanted her to be like other mothers. And she, the stories that we tell about her girlhood, where she wore hats backward and they said, well, put a cross in the thing that belongs on the front of the hat in the back, was true that as a mother, I'm sure that we must look clumsily dressed. And I know that in many years, when I was, I would say in the years between 1912 and 1918, we would go to a boys' department and pick out things from like midi bars and skirts and things like that. They were all alike, and sailor hats and boys, everything, and then they could be handed down. Of course, by the time they reached the boys, they'd been worn out by the girls. But therefore, we looked very tailored, but not very attractive, I have to say. And it made most of us very eager to develop that kind of side in us where we, as grown women, kept up with fashion and kept up with, and I found a department store, you didn't have any choice. You had to be leading in fashion. You had to wear hats, you had to wear high school, you had to wear high heel shoes. And if you didn't, you'd get fired because you were a representative of the fact that they had attractive buyers and so on there. So I think that might surprise people that mother, having gone through the embarrassment of this herself, wasn't, either she didn't have time, which might have been the whole thing, or she her natural instincts, which had made her blind to this, wearing hats herself, made her also blind to the fact that we children wanted to look a little bit more individually, attractively dressed, let's put it that way, instead of looking like an orphanage.
Did she always wear black? Did Grandeur always wear black?
No, she wore, my dad loved her in black the best, so that's why she wore it, but also on trips and so on, black, as we all know, is easier to handle on a trip than other colors. It doesn't seem to wrinkle so badly, and you seem to wear it more times, I think. But she so often did wear black when you saw her, and that's because she traveled so much it was more practical.
It was probably flattering with her hair color, too.
Yes, it was.
Well, do you think that is one of the reasons you went into buying in retail, because you were attracted to fashion? And
without any question.
That's interesting.
Without any question. And we were encouraged to sew and design clothes and so on. Dad would not give us any real money for finished clothes, but if we made them ourselves, then I made all kinds of things, which were kind of bizarre. But anyhow, that's what I did. So, I love them. I still do.
Well, how did the idea for writing Cheaper by the Dozen come about?
Oh, we've known from the time we were telling stories to our fellow schoolmates, and they were convulsed with laughter that they were timeless, and that we just knew that from the time we were born almost.
Did you and Frank always assume that you would be the two to write that? Did you and Frank always assume that you would be the two to tell the
story? No, we stepped up, as I said in Teddy's article. We had been in various projects before. We were in one where we used an empty room in our Providence house where Moses study was developed in that house, where we had a calendar and gift card business and this and that and the other thing that we sold to people of the household, and had Billy deliver it. And it was that place where Dad came back with pictures of his engineers and himself with the Prince of Wales and the King and Queen visiting. We had a family magazine that he edited, and it was Bill, his best way, turned down all those pictures that he submitted to us, because we didn't think that they were of great general interest, and that was one of his prized things. And that, so he started another magazine. But anyhow, that's been written up a good bit, that we did turn that down because we thought that our own happenings were more interesting than those in England. But I do have right here some wonderful stuff about that exhibit. And it was a special Olympia or something or other exhibit about the year 1919, I think, with a lot of publicity in all the papers there, Queen Mary and my dad and everything else. And to have a certain rejected for our magazine really half killed him.
I bet.
Yeah. You know, I don't know if I answered your question there, but
I think you did. It sounds like you had always been thinking that it was something you would do.
Oh, I think it was. Oh, well, with Frank. So we had the first thing of the where we sold the calendars. Then we had a chicken business that we had, and we had about 24 of the Rhode Island Reds. They were behind our garage there. We didn't feed them properly, so they were taken away from us, and we began to eat them each Sunday, which was like eating a member of the family.
I imagine.
Each one had a name. But anyhow, so that was our second business together. And then Frank and I have tended to team up. We're much, I think, more like mother than a good many of the others. I think Bob Gilbreth is my youngest brother now, that's taken over from Dad, representing the ones in the family. He's a spit of mother. Amazing to me. He looks just like her.
Wow.
And I don't think he's mother's temperament, but Nor do I think he's Frank's or my temper, but when I see a picture, I get a startled feeling.
Well, can you tell me about some of your other writings that you've done since those two books? I know you've written other books since then.
Well, I have written three published books, and one of them was on our marriage. And I don't think the books tell any stories that the children did of our marriage today, so I was particularly interested in their stories. But anyhow, that was called Rings Around Us. And then I've written two novels on a department store. And now Sarah and I are working on the typing and finishing of one of a memoir of my years in the 1930s in the department store as assistant buyer in Toys and Macy's in Pearl Square, which was one of my jobs. That is a book that was written earlier in Arizona but never completely finished because of interruptions. So we're beginning to pull out some old manuscript and trying to begin to think of marketing them through our agent.
Wonderful.
And I don't know whether we'll be successful, but we'll try.
That's great.
So I have a bunch of juvenile stories every now and again. If I feel like it, I'll sit down and write a child story.
Long enough, so she's got
to
get her social security.
Not ready to retire yet.
Well, I have a bunch of manuscript, and I've got all kinds of things. But at heart, I would say the thing I love best is research. I love the research. That's why when I hear about this whole thing, I have been there, and I know exactly when it's a joy and when it isn't, and when it's helpful and when it isn't, so on.
Well, looking back at your life, can you tell me what one of your fondest memories is?
Well, some of my memories are not my fondest, but they are. I don't really think I have very many fond memories. I think I had intriguing ones, but they're not fond. Here's one that I'll tell you that is not fond at all. But I've always been crazy about plants, as you can see outside. And when I was about 5 or 6, Mother took me downtown with her. I was the only one with her that day, and bought me a book. I guess I had a birthday coming up, and I selected the Robinson. I selected Stevenson's, and Does It Not Seem Sad to You When All the Sky is Clear and Blue.
Right.
Robert Louis Stevenson. That's right. So anyhow, we had that, but it wasn't enough for me. So we went through a department store, and there was a table like this, and it was filled with hyacinths in bloom, and they were blue, most of them. And I think they're 29 cents. And I had to have one. And I said to Mother, I have to have one. And she said, well, I'm sorry, dear, but we're late. We're not going to pause and buy that now. I realized today that she realized if I came home with something like that, beyond the book, there'd be trouble with everybody that didn't get the same thing. But anyhow, I was so angry with it, I just threw myself down the floor. I liked to do that a lot when I was a child. And threw myself down the floor and just cried and hollered, and people gathered around, they thought she'd hurt me. And so Mother looked at the situation and said, well, I'm sorry, dear, but we're late getting home. I'm going to go, and if you want to follow me, you can. So she turned around and started over. Of course, I was right up in an instant following her. Now, that's not my fondest memory by any means, but it's one of my most vivid. And then I have another one about my grandmother. And these are not in our books, but they will be in memorandums, I hope, someday here. My grandmother taught us all to read. She would sometimes have 6 of us around her in the sunshine in her room on the second floor at Providence, and she would read. And I always was old enough so I would have to squat on the floor on my knees and then put my chin on the top of the primer. And so then it came time for me to go to kindergarten. And where the other children didn't have the skill, I announced right away fast that I could read. So the teacher said, well, that's just lovely, Ernestine. Why don't you get up here and read to us then? So I welcomed that. I evidently thought I was great. So she handed me the paper, and I couldn't read a thing. So I just broke down and cried all over the thing. And then I took the book and turned it upside down, and I read fine. And it was because my chin had been on the book. This way I had learned to read upside down. So my grandmother was a teacher, and she said, this child is never going to enjoy reading. She's always going to be slow in method in writing and everything else because of this. And my father said, well, you're a trained teacher. You taught in Maine for many years. You shouldn't have let that happen. And he teased her terribly about it. Well, she said, we're going to see a limping child on this subject. It didn't hurt me at all.
Wow.
And today, and in my New York years, I could read the newspaper. Other people would be reading newspapers. You look down, read the newspaper fine when it's upside down. So, I still can. And I could do some writing upside down. So.
Oh, my gosh.
So that isn't one of my fondest memories at all. But it's just one of the first ones.
Well, about how old were you whenever you went with your mother to and saw the blue hyacinths and everything? How old were you then? Do you remember?
What color?
How old were you whenever you went with your mother?
Well, I was at different ages. I think that, first of all, when I would fall in love with something, I had to have a desk. I didn't like the one. And I was half sick until we got that desk. So I had a special trip with mother to get the desk, and she got it early and then gave it to me for my birthday. But she had it tucked away and supposedly hidden until my birthday, but I knew where it was, and I was going to look at it. But she would usually take you at a time when you really needed to be, or at a time where I think she had to get away from the household. She took me one day, I recall, to church very impulsively. And I think the whole household probably had, for a moment, was just too much. But she would tend, if things were too much for her, she would always tend to grab me by the arm. I think I remind me of our own childhood. And my father would take Frank where things were often too much for him. He would put the hat on Frank and he'd say, come on, he called him Franco. Come on, Franco, let's get out of here. I remember that, where they went, I don't know. But I do remember going to church with mother and feeling that something was wrong.
Yeah.
And that church was going to straighten it out. Congregational church. Is that accurate?
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Well, would you do anything differently in your life now, looking back?
Oh, I probably could have done 99,000 things differently. It just happened that I usually chose the most difficult thing. I don't know why, to see whether I could come through with it. I think I have a lot of my father in me there. It doesn't show, but I think I thrive under challenge. And even if I'm dead tired and all the odds are against me, I still am quite interested in trying to beat that situation. Yeah.
So you enjoy testing your...
I enjoy things that are hard. And that with careful thought, you can figure out a way of doing it and succeeding. But I'm sure I would do 99,000 things differently. I might have married 8 or 10 different men in my life. But it just happened that I married the one I thought I'd enjoy the most.
Well, if you could leave future generations with one thought or one impression of your life or your parents' lives, what would it be?
I was have your work about to something that communicates it with other people. And that means a lot to me. And having it affect them in a positive way. And perhaps stir them on to try to do it themselves. I think that that's one thing about a big family. It wants you, it's not hard, not easy, but it wants you to benefit and have other people benefit from that experience. And it's all for you.
That's right.
So then they asked me why I just had 2 children.
Yeah, well, I thought you probably got sick of that question, but I will ask.
two children were all we could fit into our lives, and my husband had to be persuaded to have two. So there we are.
So that was two more than you, he thought he would have.
He didn't want any kids at once at the beginning.
Well, it sounds like he changed his mind.
Well, I guess life changed his mind. I think when he saw some of his nieces and nephews, he couldn't help them.
I've got one more question for you. You've been a lifelong supporter of libraries and education and literacy. What have libraries meant to you throughout your life?
Well, the strongest influence in my life. Without any question, I'm a product of libraries for better or worse. Certainly in every difficult situation in my life where I had to, I guess the way Mother had to get to church that time, I've had to go to libraries. There have been a lot of times where I just needed to get a sense of refreshment and balance, and that's where I get it. It's my passion, if you want to know, and I care.
That's beautiful. Well, are there any things you'd like to say to have on the record?
Well, are we talking about Purdue now?
Just anything.
Well, I think I said one thing right there. I would say with Purdue that I carry with me today, as you talk to me, I'm not a graduate of Purdue, but because of the family relationship, I just literally have a love affair with Purdue. There's no question about that. At the same time, as often as with the person you love, you can be critical of them. And I have had some quiet criticisms of them. And some of them have come up in our conversation today. And I'm thrilled that Purdue is aware of this problem and is finding ways of solving it today, and that being here today, you're going to try to see how we can fit into that picture of helping you. Well, that makes me happy. Does that answer?
It does. Thank you so much for letting me interview you.
No, you do. Your questions are good, dear. They made me think.
Well, I enjoyed it very much.
I too.